Today on the World, after weeks of protests and violence, Sudan's military rulers agree to share power with the opposition until elections can be held. But many in Sudan doubt the generals will give up their power.
Many of them have a lot to lose because they were part of the 30-year regime of Omar al-Bashir. And so they would want to be in power to protect themselves and what they have.
Also, a visit to the Museum of the Palestinian People in Washington, just blocks from the White House.
We welcome people with open hearts, right, to come and have a conversation with us. And it doesn't matter if they agree or not. The most important is the conversation.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories, plus a preview of the Women's World Cup final on Sunday. All of that today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Celebrations in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, today. After months of massive, sometimes violent protests, pro-democracy advocates and the ruling military party have reached a deal. The two sides agreed to create a joint council and share power for the next 3 years until elections are held. Anne Soy is senior Africa correspondent for the BBC. She says the deal comes after a long stalemate between the two sides.
So finally they agreed that each side would give five members to the Sovereign Council, and there's an 11th member who we understand will be a civilian but may or may not be a military leader. And that has caused skepticism and issues with the supporters of the opposition alliance, because they say if he's a retired military officer, so is he fully civilian? To whom does he or she pledge their allegiance? So they have received this. They have been celebrating about this development, but there's also a lot of skepticism.
So negotiations between the two sides had been going on for months. They even broke down at some point. You were just in Khartoum covering the story earlier this week. What has changed?
The mediation from the African Union and Ethiopia is what changed things, as well as international pressure from the United Nations, from the US government, from the British government, and also Gulf states.
Along with this power-sharing agreement, it was also announced that there's going to be an investigation into the attack by military last month in Khartoum on a sit-in that killed at least 100 people. Who will ensure that investigation is going to be fair and impartial?
So the agreement was that they would form a joint investigations team that would look into that deadly crackdown of June the 3rd. There is still skepticism also with this issue, because people are asking, so if it implicates some of the military rulers, will they agree to the findings of that investigation? Will they agree to be, to step aside and not to be part of the government? Many of them have a lot to lose because they were part of the 30-year regime of Omar al-Bashir. And so they would want to be in power to protect themselves and what they have, and also to sort of shield themselves from prosecution for alleged atrocities committed during that 30-year rule.
The BBC's Anne Soy, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
So just how optimistic are Sudanese following this agreement?
You know, I'm cautiously optimistic that at least for a while there will be less tension.
Suleiman Baldo is with the Enough Project, a U.S.-based group that works in several conflict areas in Africa, including in his native Sudan.
Believe me, the population would be looking very carefully to see if this effort is going to be credible and legitimate.
Yeah, I'm sure the population is going to be watching this carefully, because we've seen these kind of power-sharing agreements before in other countries between military and civilians. It often does not work out. Who's going to enforce this agreement?
Well, you have seen also the mass protest organized in Sudan since last December. And the numbers were so overwhelming that they really forced the hand of the Transitional Military Council, that this population is not going to be cowered down because of use of massive force against it. And that population would be the only safeguard and the protector of the agendas of the transition. And I believe there will need to be a lot of involvement at high level from the Troika of the US, UK, and Norway, from the European Union and the United Nations, who all have special envoys for the crisis in Sudan and who have been monitoring and supporting the African Union mediation efforts. And without this global partnership with the African Union, I don't think that we can trust the military to basically act honestly throughout the transition.
Speaking of the military in Sudan, what about this commander known as Hemeti, the Janjaweed leader? He's suspected of atrocities and still wields a lot of power. Is he still a concern? Or will he be a spoiler to this agreement?
He definitely stands as the, you know, a very likely spoiler of the agreement. Hemeti, the warlord, head of a militia, he was a member of the Janjaweed, rose to prominence as the, you know, perpetrator of the genocide in Darfur. And therefore, again, I am hopeful and counting on the resilience of the pro-democracy movement in Sudan to neutralize any harmful effects or spoiler effect that Hemeti could bring to the situation, starting by investigating crimes that his forces had committed, including in recent weeks.
Suleiman, you put a lot of weight, it seems, on the people power in Sudan that got the country to this point. Do you expect the protests to continue?
You know, there is a jubilation, but very guarded optimism also in Khartoum. People want a break after months of being out in the streets, and they also want to go to work and to feed their families. And the country is in the middle of a major financial and economic collapse. And therefore, they would welcome giving this arraignment a chance to show that it's the right one. And if it isn't, you know, they will be back on the streets and they will make the country ungovernable.
Suleiman Baldo speaking with us about the new power-sharing agreement in Sudan. Suleiman's with the Enough Project, an NGO that works in conflict areas across Africa. Thank you very much, Suleiman.
Thanks.
Later this hour, how one trauma therapist in Khartoum has taught people to cope during months of unrest there. President Trump generated a lot of conversation around the military parade he threw yesterday for the 4th of July. Not all of it positive.
Well, the 4th of July is really a salute to independence and to freedom and to the values of America.
That's former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter. He says we have Veterans Day and Memorial Day as military holidays. I talked to him today about his new book, Inside the Five-Sided Box, Lessons from a Lifetime of Leadership in the Pentagon. But we started with this week's holiday.
So it's fine for the military to be part of things, but what they're really supposed to be doing is training for war. The military is not for parades. It's supposed to be training for war.
So at what point does the Secretary of Defense need to put his or her foot down and say, no, we're not going to do X, Y, or Z because that is politicizing the armed forces?
One of the jobs is to protect the institution from politicization. So they should put their foot down. I was Secretary of Defense during the 2016 election campaign, for example. And I was asked every day, candidate so-and-so, remember there were 20 or so candidates one day, said thus and so, would you comment on it? And I would say, no, I won't, because I'm the Secretary of Defense. And furthermore, I'm not going to allow other military officers to comment on it. It's inappropriate. We have civilian control of the military in this country, but we also have a depoliticized military. Very important principle. And another thing I just have to say is I'm a stickler for personal conduct, because we were very strict on personal conduct in the military. I mean, you're not lying, screwing around with subordinates. These kinds of things we are very hard on in the military. And I think you need to set an example. And I see in Washington these days a kind of personal conduct that, you know, is not good for our young people to see.
Secretary Carter, the rapidly escalating tensions in the Gulf between the U.S. and Iran right now, leaders in Washington and Tehran say they don't want a fight, but stumbling into a shooting war seems increasingly likely. How could the situation, in your view, spiral out of control? What would that look like?
Well, Marco, I think you used the right word, which is stumbling. I don't think either our country, and the president has expressed himself on this, wants a war. He just said that. And the Iranians have to know they're not in a strong position. So the problem is not intentional war. It's unintentional war. Now, when I was in office, 10 sailors mistakenly sailed into Iranian waters, were detained. And that was immediately, I mean, I was alerting forces. We had airplanes in the air. And we take that real seriously when our people are detained. Now, fortunately, the Iranians released them very quickly. But if that were to happen today with all this tension, that kind of thing that crosses a line, that's where you get unintentional conflict in an atmosphere of tenseness.
Yeah, and looking at it that way, as you reflect back on the Iran nuclear treaty, what benefits do you see of that today?
Well, first of all, it was a purely nuclear agreement. So as Secretary of Defense, it took off my plate, one of my headaches with Iran, but it didn't take all the headaches off. And I think one of the critiques of the Iran deal was that it didn't do everything. Now, that wouldn't have led me to recommend to the president that he throw it out, but that's crying over spilled milk now. You ask what effect it's had. While President Obama was still in office, they did all this stuff that was irreversible, like destroy a nuclear reactor, destroy a bunch of centrifuges. So we get that benefit, even though we walked away from the agreement.
Technology and the military is another big theme in your book. And as former Secretary of Defense and a physicist, you sought out collaborations with tech companies and Silicon Valley. How do you weigh the benefits and risks of these partnerships, especially when a lot of these tech companies have been platforms for serious challenges to civil society?
I mean, first of all, getting them to work for us was a challenge because back in the old days when I started out as a physicist, it was natural to work with the government. In the generation that followed, some of these companies and some of these technologists felt they had no duty to the government. And I tried to turn that around in the interest of defense because we need to stay technologically advanced if we're going to continue to be good. Now, you're right. The same attitude that caused some people in the tech community not to work with defense caused them not to care about other social consequences of their work. That's why you see the filthiness of much social media. That's why people have concerns about artificial intelligence being applied to their lives. This is why we're concerned about jobs and training and the way technology can take jobs and nobody seems to care. These are serious matters where technologists have a responsibility to their fellow human beings. They need to pay attention to their social and human responsibilities. So we need some government regulation and we need some self-regulation by people that don't know better.
You're talking about like the Facebooks, the Zuckerbergs,
sure.
The Twitter?
Yeah. Yeah. These are long overdue self-awareness.
Given how technology was crucial to the manipulation of the 2016 election, do you view that as an act of war?
Certainly was deliberate aggression by Russia. And I bet you'll ask me next, did we do enough? And no, I'll tell you we didn't and we still haven't. If you need evidence of that, just look at Vladimir Putin. Does this look like a man who's chastened?
Well, the next question was, how should the U.S. be preparing for 2020?
We got to get really good at this because things are changing. The game plan that was used in 2016 is already outdated. The way technology moves, you're going to see deep fakes. You're going to see a daily barrage of rubbish.
And deep fakes are basically videos where you cannot determine whether what is being said by the subject is real or not.
Right. And for several hours at least, people will be led to believe that a certain candidate said something ridiculous. And some people will never see the second story that says that was rubbish.
You're saying we got to get good at this, but it's 2019 and the election is what, like 17, 16 months away?
Yeah.
So what do we need to do?
Well, two things. Some of it is exactly what you were talking about a minute ago, Marco, the responsibility of social media companies to partner with government to make sure they're not manipulated. The other thing is just being a resilient society. I think our people are more canny now than they were in 2016. I think everybody's going to need to not only count to 10, but count to several hundred after they see an emotionally stimulating story about the election. And before they get all fired up about it, wait to see whether it's really true.
Former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Some of Europe is still cooling down from a record-breaking heat wave. Some places have seen the mercury creep back up. Unprecedented high temperatures have led to school closures, wildfires, and in some cases, death. In France, where temperatures were well above 100 degrees Fahrenheit, people were on alert. For example, in Toulouse, charities were handing out water to homeless people who were especially vulnerable. Also in Toulouse last week, there was a meeting of the World Weather Attribution Group. They study the connection between climate change and extreme weather. Geert Jan van Oldenborg was there. He's a senior researcher at the Royal Netherlands Meteorological Institute. Thanks for being with us. So when this heat wave hit Europe last week, you and many of your colleagues happened to be at this conference in Toulouse. What was the conference all about?
It was a conference on statistical climatology. And so all the people that study the relationship between extreme weather and climate were there discussing their latest findings, and we just happened to be there in the middle of a heat wave.
So you were talking about climate change, and then this heat wave hit. So
It was even worse than that. A few months ago, I had proposed to give a talk there about how to connect heat waves to climate change. And I could just refer to the weather outside during my talk.
Yeah. So was this all everyone at the conference was talking about?
Not all, but of course, yes, it was a topic of conversation. And while all my colleagues were there, we decided to do an attribution of the heat wave, i.e. try to compute how more likely it had become due to climate change.
So this is all happening in real time. You're at the conference, you're sitting there with your colleagues, and everyone's looking at their smartphones, checking up on the weather. You're looking outside, and suddenly someone says, let's do the study.
Actually, on the first day I was there, we just met each other and said hi, and we said, well, we have to do this. And they agreed. So we were listening to the talks, and in the breaks and the evenings, we were working on our laptops, extracting the data, looking at the forecast, and trying to make sense of it.
So tell us what some of the findings were from the study.
Well, the most surprising finding was that for the month of June, heat waves in that part of France have gone up in temperature by about 7 degrees Fahrenheit. And that is rather a lot. And we checked it and double-checked it, but it seemed to be a real signal.
Why was there so much heat? I mean, are you able to account for, like, this moment?
The immediate cause of a heat wave is always the weather. In this case, there was a very strong southerly wind from the Sahara to southern Europe. And that wind just brought very, very warm air from the Sahara Desert to the south of Europe. The part that climate change plays a role is that the wind is warmer than it would have been without climate change. And hence, Europe has heated more in this heat wave than the same heat wave would have been without climate change.
How surprised were you and your colleagues by these results?
Well, in most of the world, heat waves are getting more intense. The globe is warming due to greenhouse gases, and so why wouldn't heat waves be warming? What is surprising is that the rate of increase of heat waves is much faster than we expected.
How hard is it to raise the alarm about heat when it's not really as visual as, like, wildfires or a flood? I mean, unless you're looking at pictures of a morgue, as we did with the big heat wave in 2003,
I think that after 2003, the message did come across. All the European countries now have heat plants, and they try to protect the vulnerable people. But you're right. If a flood would kill 100 people, it would be front page news. If a heat wave kills 100 people, you only find out about it a few weeks later, and nobody notices, really. And that is strange.
Do you think this is the new normal, 100-plus degrees in late June in areas throughout Europe?
If you look back the last few years, I mean, almost every year there has been a big heat wave somewhere in Europe, and it will only get worse as long as we keep on emitting CO2.
Dr. Geert Jan van Oldenborg at the Royal Netherlands Meteorological Institute. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Washington, D.C. is full of museums where you can learn about people and communities from all over the world, but there has not been a museum dedicated to Palestinian history and culture until this summer when the Museum of the Palestinian People opened its doors. Michaela Lafrak of WAMU paid a visit.
When visitors walk into the one-room museum, the first object they see is a leafy green water jug. It's made of glass from Hebron, a city in the West Bank known for its glass-blowing traditions. What visitors won't see is overtly political content, even in a museum about an area that's at the center of a decades-long geopolitical conflict. Museum founder Bashara Nassar says his goal is to create a space that's more personal than political.
We want to really transform the story and put Palestinians in light that we're human beings, right? We're artists, we're entrepreneurs. We're in politics, and we're contributing a lot to the U.S. as immigrants as well.
Nassar immigrated to the U.S. from the West Bank in 2011. When he came to Washington, he saw a city full of museums, but he didn't see one that reflected him.
Really, I could not see a place where the Palestinian story can be told.
So he decided to open a traveling exhibition that would eventually become the museum. One of the objects in the collection is a 1946 passport for the Palestine Mandate. It was rendered useless the following year after the United Nations voted to establish the State of Israel. Curator Neda O'Day wants visitors to understand that history.
We want them to learn that there is a country was called Palestine. It existed.
O'Day maintains that the museum is not political, and there isn't any mention of political leaders, protesters, or human rights abuses on either side of the conflict. But there are certain phrases that some people will inevitably take issue with, like signage about the Nakba, or catastrophe. That's the word Palestinians use to describe the time surrounding the creation of Israel. As O'Day puts it,
there is a true story. There is people who were displaced because of someone came and took the land.
The museum is just a mile away from the White House. President Trump has been a staunch supporter of the Israeli government, and the museum's opening comes 9 months after his administration closed the Palestinian Liberation Organization's D.C. office. But Nassar says he started dreaming up the museum before Trump was elected. He wants it to be a place of conversation, not protest.
We welcome people with open hearts, you know, and with open arms, right? To come and have a conversation with us. And it doesn't matter if they agree or not. It's the most important is the conversation.
In the museum's first few weeks, a group of monks visited and a group from the liberal pro-Israel organization J Street. But most of the visitors have been Palestinian Americans, like one young man named Yusuf Hamid. He showed off his Palestinian flag necklace.
Palestine on my neck.
He signed his name in Arabic on a wall for visitor feedback.
I really loved it, honestly. Like, I'm new to D.C., exploring the area, and then this was the first event, like, I came across, and I knew this was what I wanted to first see when I came here. Yeah.
Hamid said seeing a museum like this, about people like him, gave him hope that the long-standing conflict might one day end. For The World, Michaela Lafrak, Washington, D.C.
Hi, I want to tell you about a new PRX podcast called Things That Go Boom. It's all about foreign policy, but not in the way you might think. At Things That Go Boom, they tell stories about our lives and the world around us in an effort to better understand the ins, outs, and what have yous of what keeps us safe. On the new season, they tell the story of the secret back-channel meetings, political ploys, and even broken bones that led to the Iran nuclear deal. And since President Trump yanked us out of that deal, they ask, are we headed for nuclear war? Things That Go Boom's second season, called Fallout, is available now. Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
U.S. soccer star Megan Rapinoe has gotten a lot of attention at the Women's World Cup, both on and off the field, and she seems okay with that.
I think that she's also proven that she can multitask and handle all of the stuff that's happening.
I'm Marco Werman. We preview Sunday's World Cup final, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. A damning report from the UN on Venezuela's security forces came out today. Allegations of thousands of extrajudicial killings by security forces loyal to President Nicolas Maduro. The goal, suppress opposition to the government. The report drew on evidence collected by the UN's human rights chief, Michelle Bachelet, on a visit to Venezuela last month. Bachelet said today the rule of law there had been deeply eroded.
A report notes attacks against actual or perceived political opponents and human rights defenders, ranging from threats and smear campaigns to arbitrary detention, torture and ill treatment, sexual violence, killings and enforced disappearance. Excessive and lethal force has repeatedly been used against protesters. My office has also documented excessive use of force in the context of security operations by the Special Action Forces, with multiple killings mainly of young men.
More than 5,000 young men dead in alleged confrontations with officers last year alone, according to the report. Venezuela's Deputy Foreign Affairs Minister William Castillo dismissed the UN report. He said it relied on selective and biased information.
Venezuela está segura de que usted sabe que el informe no refleja la realidad de lo que vio en nuestro país.
Castillo said Venezuela is sure that Bachelet knows the report does not reflect the reality in the country. The fact is, though, nearly 4 million people have fled Venezuela. Most have taken refuge just across the border in countries like Colombia. But some Venezuelans have gone much farther from home, as Rebecca Collard reports from Lebanon.
In central Beirut, just off the main road, is Tucano, a South American restaurant. Inside Firas, Yordi is flattening cornmeal dough to make traditional Venezuelan arepes.
Pero nunca llegué a pensar vivir aquí en el Líbano.
Yordi never thought he would end up in Lebanon. His Lebanese father immigrated to Venezuela 50 years ago.
Época muy difícil de su vida.
My father came from a very humble background, and it was tough times in Lebanon back then. There were always threat of war and violence happening.
For Yordi's father, the choice of Venezuela wasn't all that surprising. The first Lebanese immigrated there in the 1860s from what was then the Ottoman Empire. Then in 1915, Lebanon experienced a famine. Tens of thousands fled, many to South America. And in the 60s and 70s, there was a third wave of Lebanese immigration. In fact, now there are more people of Lebanese descent living outside Lebanon than in it.
Y bueno, decidí migrar.
By the time Yordi's father arrived, Venezuela already had a thriving Lebanese community.
An older house.
Yordi shows me pictures on his phone of their life in Venezuela before the crisis. Photos of them scuba diving, family vacations and weddings. Their two-story home with a pool. His family owned several car repair shops and a factory that made beds and mattresses.
Siempre estuvimos en el comercio, pues, y
business was very well and life was very well for many, many years, and then it started deteriorating.
And even when Venezuela's economy collapsed, Yordi stayed. Then 2 years ago, two men on a motorcycle tried to snatch his four-year-old son from in front of the family's factory. He tears up when he talks about his decision to leave. A year ago, he arrived in Lebanon, a place he'd only heard about in stories from his parents. His wife and child were already here.
Recibido muy bien. Muchas veces se ríen de mi forma de hablar.
People have treated me very well. Sometimes they make fun of how I speak, my broken Arabic and my accent, but it's in a joking manner. And they tell
you already had extended family in Lebanon to welcome him, though he says it's still been tough.
The most difficult thing was starting anew, starting from zero, throwing all the progress that my business had made there and just basically tossing it to the trash and coming to a new country and starting from scratch.
Yordi opened Tucano with another immigrant, a man from Brazil whose parents are also from Lebanon. The small shop serves arepes and empanadas, but also tacos and burritos. Lebanon is already hosting about 1 million refugees from neighboring Syria. They're prohibited from working and they're under increasing pressure to go home. But Yordi's situation is different. He's just received his Lebanese ID, which is basically his citizenship papers. It's not clear how many Venezuelans of Lebanese descent have moved here, but Yordi says there are hundreds that have come by his restaurant for a taste of home.
A lot of my clientele here at the restaurant are people who were born in Venezuela and moved to Lebanon.
But Yordi's parents stayed in Venezuela. He says they're too old to uproot their lives again. Yordi's father used to send money back home to his struggling family during Lebanon's civil war. Now Yordi says that's reversed, and he's sending money to his parents in Venezuela.
Por el mismo estrés de la vida diaria allá en Venezuela.
My mother suffered a stroke, and now she's at home recovering. It's very difficult for her. Also, my father needs three types of insulin because he's diabetic that are hard to find in Venezuela. So we try sometimes to send them the medicine that they need from here or from the States.
Yordi's not sure if he and his family will ever move back to Venezuela. He says everything is just so uncertain. But he knows in some ways he's lucky. Most refugees don't have another country that welcomes them home. For The World, Rebecca Collard, Beirut.
Mosquitoes are more than a summer nuisance. In places where they carry malaria, the consequences of a mosquito bite can be dire and even deadly. That's why the experiment underway in Burkina Faso in West Africa this week is a big deal. On Monday afternoon, scientists released 10,000 genetically modified mosquitoes in one village. The idea is that these GMO mosquitoes will spread a gene into the wild mosquito population that could eventually wipe out the malaria-carrying mosquitoes. This has never been tried outside of a lab anywhere. The insects released this week are sterile. They won't actually spread the gene. But if the idea works, it could be a game changer. Abdoulaye Diabaté leads a project for the nonprofit Target Malaria. He put 10,000 mosquitoes in context for me.
10,000 mosquitoes compared, you know, to the total number of population size of mosquitoes in the field is pretty much nothing at all.
Right.
But for us, it was really extremely important because, you know, we wanted to collect consistent and robust scientific data on mosquitoes' behavior, you know, the flight pattern and flight dispersal, the longevity. All these specific scientific data will inform, you know, the next step of the work that we are doing. And a second objective for us also was, you know, to make sure that with this release, it gives us time, you know, to interact a lot with the community so that they are absolutely aware of the work that we are doing, if there is any concern, so that they can bring this concern that we can factor into the development process.
What are the potential risks of wiping out a species, though, like even a species of malaria-carrying mosquitoes?
First of all, let me just tell you that we have about 3,500 species of mosquitoes across the world. And just for the region of Africa, we have 850 mosquito species. So Target Malaria is just targeting only one species, which is the major malaria vector in Africa, and mostly, I would say, in Burkina Faso. So if targeting only one species can help to save millions of lives, I think it's really important and worth doing it.
So let's say all goes well with this phase in the study. What happens next?
Because we did the release on Monday, so we have to do the monitoring of these mosquitoes up to 1 year just to see how they behave. But the next step is that as soon as we're done with this, so we will have to submit application, you know, to the national regulatory agency, you know, for a second construct. Once we have enough data from there and then we feel confident, then we can transform that and then insert now the gene drive component in it. And this is going to be the final product that we will use at some point in the field.
And how many years down the road do you think that's going to be?
I will say that if it was just based on the technical science part, it will be really, very fast, maybe in 2 or 3 years. But you have to understand that because this is a new technology, so there are really very several components in it. Safety is really paramount to us. And then to make really sure that before you get to the final product, you have a social license from the community where you are operating to accept, you know, the product that you're bringing here. And this is the work that we are doing. And this is going to take a little bit of time. And so we feel that it may take us maybe something like maybe 6 or 7 years down the line, you know, to have the final product and bring it to the field.
Abdoulaye Diabaté, you're from Burkina Faso. How did you get interested in mosquitoes in the first place?
You know, I don't really know anyone in Burkina Faso who was born here and raised here and then who has not been, you know, through malaria. I have experienced malaria several times when I was a kid, all my brothers and sisters, and I am even talking to you today as a parent. So I have all my kids also who went, you know, through malaria episode. And this is something really very difficult, you know, to sustain, not only psychologically, but also you spend a lot of money for. And Africa has been, you know, suffering from malaria for really several decades. You know, at the beginning of the bed net, to see that we were having such a very good impact, we were very excited. But at some point, we realized that because of insecticide resistance, so we were kind of having a plateau in efficacy. And we feel that it's important for us, you know, to move to something else that can help us. I feel like, okay, if there are really way for us, you know, to better study these mosquitoes that are transmitting the disease and then come up with tools that can help to fight and reduce the burden on Africa, this is really the right thing for us to do.
Well, Dr. Abdoulaye Diabaté, lead mosquito researcher with Target Malaria in Burkina Faso, thank you for explaining your work. Good luck.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Along with innovative scientists, African musicians have also played a role in fighting malaria. Robot malaria, children and science. Like the song from Ghana's Malaria-Free Future campaign. Kids singing about getting rid of stagnant water in tires and at the bottom of food tins that attract mosquitoes. Not exactly inspiring concepts for a song, but some pop musicians have taken the mosquito malaria theme and made it sexy, even danceable. Cheyenne Kuti and the Egypt 80 from Nigeria have the mosquito song. And then there's Zhao from Congo, who wrote this one simply titled in French, Moustique, with the unforgettable line, mosquito, mosquito, you're an assassin. Moustique, moustique. Moustique, moustique, tu es un bandit. Moustique, moustique, tu es un...
piques, tu me piques. Moi je dors pas, ah tu es un salaud. Tu viens chanter à mon oreille sans avoir peur. Ah tu es un jeune. Tu es tout petit, tu tapes les grands. Ah tu es un salaud. Tu rentres dans ma moustiquaire sans rendez-vous. Ah tu es un intrus. Tu suces mon sang, tu amènes dans les usines où l'on fabrique du vin rouge. Je vais te porter plainte au tribunal chez monsieur le juge.
We stay in Africa, but move to the east side of the continent now, to Sudan. We spoke earlier on the show about the new power-sharing deal between civilians and the military there. Sudanese are cautiously optimistic about what that agreement will lead to. It won't erase the last few months in Sudan, though. They've been difficult and violent.
The massacre had one aim: break the revolution by traumatizing its supporters.
More than 100 people were shot dead and dozens of women and men allegedly raped when security forces rushed the sit-in and opened fire.
A peaceful sit-in came to a bloody end on June 3rd in Khartoum, and protesters have had to cope with the trauma of that massacre. 43-year-old Suleyma Ishak Sharif is a counselor at the main trauma center at Afhad University in Khartoum. She kept an audio diary for us.
So we set up a clinical, a mobile clinic procedures that we go to the people rather than then let's come to the center. Because it's not very safe in the streets, not very safe for them, it's not even safe everywhere. So then we go and we distributed ourselves geographically in Khartoum. And then people call you. We actually work 7/24. Yeah, I try to teach them basic skills, sleep hygiene. How to sleep without the substance, how to induce sleep, how to create some kind of sleep routine that gives signals to your brain, then you get sleepy by that time if you just train yourself. It teaches them also something grounding. They touch something they like or they're very familiar with. Then when you're re-experiencing things, they're not having the same feelings. So they tell themselves they are in the present and they're safe right now. Nothing is happening to them, so it really helps them.
Sometimes when I was providing psychosocial support to somebody, I feel I'm too much involved. I'm doing a lot of things. People feel a little anxious, stressed. So I always talk about, like, rely on your relationship. Talk to somebody. It doesn't have to be a professional. You just talk. And that's helped a lot of people. And it helped me as well. So it's a network of love and support that help you to get through.
Hi, it's Suleyma again. How are you? So one of the things that helped me a lot is also be with my children.
It's quite late in the evening today. It is actually midnight.
They're not sleeping yet. They're supposed to be asleep.
But they don't want to. What do you want to say?
Could you sing something for Sudan? Could you sing something for Sudan?
So I encourage other people to enjoy their fatherhood, motherhood, enjoy their friendship, as well as enjoying the relationship with others.
يا بني السودان هذا رمزكم يحمل العبء ويحمل.
Suleyma Ishak Sharif is a trauma counselor in Khartoum, Sudan. Boeing said this week it will pay $100 million to communities in Ethiopia and Indonesia affected by the two deadly crashes of the company's 737 MAX planes. The money won't go directly to the families of victims. Instead, the airline will donate the money to local governments and nonprofits, which can then distribute it to the families. But how that will work exactly is still murky. Boeing did say the money can be used for education, hardship, and living expenses. And families who get the money don't have to waive any legal rights. They can still sue the company over the tragedy. We wanted to hear from the families themselves and how they are reacting to the news. So we reached out to a woman named Konjit Shafi in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Her brother, Sintayu, died in the crash of Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 back in March. He was only 31 years old.
He was so strong. He was helpful. He was a perfectionist. He was my little brother. It's so difficult to lose him.
Kanjeet said her brother was a Toyota technician in Addis, and he took a lot of pride in his work. She texted us a bunch of photos of him, one where he had just won first place in a skills competition at work, and another where he's shaking hands with a Toyota executive in Japan after he won an International Customer Service Award. We found a video of the award ceremony on YouTube.
Champions, please enter the hall!
Sintayu looked so happy. Kanjeet says the money Boeing pledged this week to crash victims' families only goes so far.
No amount of money can return back our loved ones. Any amount of money will not cure our injury. But the good thing is the aim of the support. Boeing intends the money for education and living expenses. That aim, if it really spent for that intended purposes, I would be happy.
But Kanjeet says she's still planning to sue Boeing over the 737 MAX crash in Ethiopia.
All families will sue in the near future too. But I can't tell how the lawsuits will accomplish now. What I need is to punish Boeing for his negligence and for losing those precious persons. It considers only its profit over safety. We are now always crying. Our families are always crying still.
That was Kanjeet Shafi. Her brother Sintayu died in a Boeing 737 MAX crash in March. She was sharing her thoughts on Boeing's pledge this week of $100 million as indirect compensation for victims' families. We heard earlier on the show about the heat waves that Europe's been dealing with. Well, FIFA, soccer's governing body, has a heat plan for this weekend, mandatory cooling breaks during matches. Temps close to 90 degrees are expected during Sunday's Women's World Cup final in Lyon, France. That's when the U.S. will face off against the Netherlands. If Team USA wins, it'll be their fourth time as World Cup champions. Writer Meg Linehan is in Lyon for the sports news site The Athletic.
I think just in general, the U.S. attack has been the story of this tournament. This offense makes or breaks this team simply because they are just the best attacking front line in the world. So I think Alex Morgan and Megan Rapinoe are the two key players for the U.S. On the Dutch side, it's going to be interesting actually because Shanice van de Sanden could be key for this team. She's struggled with some decision making, some passing. But if she actually makes the right decision, she could actually be the player to watch for the Netherlands.
So you mentioned Megan Rapinoe. She's gotten a lot of attention. Four goals crucial to advance the U.S. To the knockout stages. But that's not what a lot of people are talking about back home. As you well know, her war of words with President Trump is dividing opinions over here. How big a factor or even a distraction has that been over there?
The team has really rallied around her. Like, I've seen a lot of people kind of suggest it's a distraction for the team. It's not. It's really not. I think a lot of them, you know, Megan Rapinoe has always been exactly this person. The quotes about, "I'm not going to the White House," all of these were done months ago. All of this is old. Like, it's not new to anyone that's been covering this team.
So that press availability is where she said things like, I think I'm particularly and uniquely and very deeply American.
Very deeply American.
So I transcribed that quote and she just basically went off the cuff for, you know, 4 minutes about basically how her week had been, how it's affected her. You know, she was like, I wasn't really expecting it from the president. He basically probably should have some better things to do with his time. But
has it all distracted her?
I don't think so. I think 2016, because that's when her protesting originally started, right? Colin Kaepernick kneeled. She was the first woman and white athlete to follow his actions. And I think that 2016 is probably still kind of the peak of reaction to what she has done since then. And I think that she's also proven that she can multitask and handle all of the stuff that's happening.
So as to the big match on Sunday, Meg, the U.S., are they the hands-down favorite, or do you think the Dutch could pull off a surprise win?
I think the Dutch can't be overlooked.
Care to give a prediction?
I gave my official prediction this morning, and what's great about my prediction is it's going to seem like I'm completely opposite what I just said. I do think the U.S. is going to win, and I think it's going to be probably by about 3-0. But the thing about that is that the U.S. has gotten those early goals, but they're so good at just wearing down teams late and scoring a couple extra. And I think that's going to be what gets them through.
U.S. over the Netherlands 3-0, according to Meg Linehan of The Athletic.
Speaking we'll see. It's always the risk. It's always the risk of being like, yes, I'm gonna officially declare some numbers. So
I won't hold you to it.
Okay.
Meg speaking with us from Lyon, France. Have a great final.
Thank you.
If you know me, you know I'll be wearing orange, red, white, and blue. Finally today, I want to take a minute to tell you about a remarkable discovery made by archaeologists in Uppsala, Sweden, on the grounds of a church. Nina Bengtsson was part of the team.
We were digging, excavating this area in last autumn, and we found a cellar dating from the 17th century and a well from the medieval age. And then we were wrapping up, and then suddenly we noticed a part of a boat below these other layers.
They actually found two boats, Viking ships that could be as old as the 9th century. One of the ancient ships was damaged, but one was mostly intact. The archaeology team uncovered medieval weaponry, a sword, spear, and shield. But what caught our attention was they also found the remains of a horse, a man, and his dog. Archaeologist Nina Bengtsson says what's next is creating a 3D model of the Viking burial site and everything found inside it. One more detail found at the site? A comb. Makes you wonder about 9th century Vikings' sense of style. Our theme music is by Ned Porter from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.